Welcome to Dispatches, a shorter podcast from the old front line, and me, military historian Paul Reed. Trench maps, the military maps that were used by those men on the battlefields of the Great War to understand that landscape. What do they tell us about the history of that conflict, and how can we use them to connect to the landscape that we know more than a century later today? When we started Dispatches, these shorter podcasts from the old front line, I mentioned that we would use it to talk about books and photographs and documents and even battlefield maps. And I'm sure many of you who listen to this podcast wondered how that would be possible. So in this episode, we're going to take an original trench map that I have on the table in front of me and talk about the history behind it on quite a few kind of different levels, really. We'll look at the history of trench maps. We'll look at what the map can tell us about the landscape of that part of the Western Front, both then and now, and hopefully see how we can use objects like this to tell a story of the Great War, because every object does have a story, a backstory often behind it. And I think more and more how important these objects that do connect us to the Great War, well, how important they are in our understanding of it. We can glean a lot from books and from research in the archives, but the objects are all part of that story as well. The objects are part of that archive, part of that culture of the Great War. And this is something I've thought about quite a lot in recent times. There is a power behind objects. I see that every time I do public history, take artifacts like this to groups who perhaps only have a kind of family history connection to the First World War. And when they see an original map or a photograph or a diary or a memorial plaque or some medals and some cap badges, I think that it sometimes triggers things in people. They remember perhaps some of these objects from their own lives, from their own family, but also they realise that history is not just an idea, it's not just a word on a page. Very much at the heart of this podcast are the stories of ordinary men and women in those extraordinary times of the First World War, and I think that the objects very much kind of typify that approach to this history, and I think that's quite important. But first of all, what are trench maps? And it's kind of a generic name for military maps of the First World War. And it's a British name, really. And I think of my old friend Peter Chasseur, who has written so much about trench maps in the First World War. His book Rat's Alley, which is a kind of gazetteer of trench names from that period, but also a kind of short history of trench maps, is a classic book, very difficult to find for many years now, back in print. Well worth seeking out. But his work on trench maps, he was one of the first big trench map collectors that I came across in my early years of being interested in the Great War. He was a member of our Sussex Western Front Association and a teacher at a Brighton school, and he used to bring some of his trench maps along to our meetings and he gave talks on them. And of course, in my own travels of searching out books connected with the First War in those kind of mythical junk shops and bookshops of Sussex back in the day, I'd often find tucked away in a dark corner a box with some old 1-to-1-inch Ordnance Survey maps in it. Amongst those would be military maps, not always just trench maps, but certainly a lot of trench maps tucked away in them. So where did these maps, the use of these trench maps, begin? Obviously, they did not exist prior to the First World War, because the idea of having some vast siege along a huge tract of Europe where both sides were entrenched was not part of most military minds in that decade or so before 1914. But there were maps, of course, and the British Army had mapped just about everywhere in the world, mapped the places where it fought, in places like the Boer War or in Egypt and places like that, mapped India over a long, long period. but it needed maps of all kinds of destinations because it never knew where it might be sent. And they had European maps, and the European maps they had were not prepared as such by British soldiers who went to France, went to Belgium and surveyed that ground. They would kind of buy in map data from other European nations and use that map data. So when we look at the maps that the British Army, the men of the British Expeditionary Force, had when they were mobilised in August 1914, they were quite large-scale maps covering big areas and based on existing pre-war local map data, French map data, Belgian map data, and it replicated the names that were used in those places in that period. So Ypres, which was in the Flemish part of Belgium, that western part of Belgium, that was its French name because in Belgium before the First World War, it was a country with two principal languages, the Wallonians speaking French, the Flemish speaking a dialect of Dutch, but the Wallonians dominated the country. It was a French-speaking country on a kind of official level, and all of its maps used French names. So a city today that we know as Ypres, its Flemish name, its current Flemish name, it's had quite a few names over the centuries. At that time, it was Ypres, and that was what was marked on the map, and that's how British soldiers knew it when they first marched into that area of Flanders in 1914. But this is true of other nations as well. So the French and the Germans used pre-war map data, and those maps were the maps that they all used when they went to war. Now, we're going to look at this largely from a British perspective because we've got a British trench map in front of us. But what the British found pretty early on in the conflict is, A, they ran out of maps very, very quickly. Not enough men, particularly at the lower level, had them. So you see in the war diaries of that 1914 period, a lot of sketch maps where men had sketched maps of the areas where they were, particularly when they first dug in places like the Aisne in September and October of 1914. And what the British, particularly the gunners, for example, find with these early maps is they were highly inaccurate, particularly when it came to contours. So if a map said that the hill was 50 metres above sea level and you calibrated your guns to fire over that hill, and actually it was 55, then the shells hit the hill. So a decision was made, particularly once the war went static on a large scale. So the end of the First Battle of Ypres, the establishment of the front lines along what became the Western Front, and the British realising they were now holding a pretty big sector from their point of view, from just south of Ypres near the village of Saint-Loire, down into northern France near to the La Bassée Canal, they needed to have decent maps. And as 1914 moved into 1915, that was ramped up a level with the utilisation of the Royal Engineers and field survey sections to go out and actually survey the ground. And this is when you begin to see some of the first proper trench maps being printed. At that time, they varied in all kinds of scales, 1 to 5,000, so pretty detailed maps were used quite a lot. You see some of those for the Battle of Neuve Chapelle in 1915. But the two standard sizes that were used for most of the rest of the war were 1 to 10,000 sheets, which quite detailed ones covering a relatively small area, and then 1 to 20,000 maps, which still had a lot of detail on, but they covered obviously a much bigger area. And you see references in war diaries from the big offences of 1915 on into the Somme and of course beyond to those two scales of maps. Those are the two principal scales. There were other sheets, 1 to 40,000 sheets that covered a very big area and even bigger maps. But what we're looking at here is what we call trench maps, which tend to be in those smaller scales that were then utilised on the battlefield. Now, this is a subject worthy of its own big podcast, and probably we will come back to that. But I kind of wanted to dip into it with dispatches and look at what one map could tell us. But coming back to the kind of story of these maps, once the line remained static and battlefield information, intelligence was so important for the attacks on static positions, and then at the same time the development of the ability to take detailed aerial photographs that could also be used in the mapping process, you see a development of British maps into what, in my opinion, are probably the best maps that were prepared by any side on the battlefield during the conflict. And, you know, I'm not just saying that because of a kind of British pride or anything, but having got examples of German trench maps and French trench maps, some Belgian maps and a lot of British maps. These ones are incredibly detailed. And the project some years ago, Great War Digital, to digitize these maps and make them GPS related so you can use them in the field, showed just how accurate some of them were, particularly later on in the war when survey methods got better and better. They're incredibly accurate maps. So they are a kind of treasure trove of history. And we're going to go into, as I say, what a map, typical map, can tell us. So let's go into this map that we've got in front of us. Now, I've had a lot of trench maps over the years. This one I recently picked up because it covered an area, as you'll discover, that has interested me for a long time. And when you have these maps and they're folded up into kind of pocket size, they were designed so they could be slipped into an officer's tunic pocket. Not just officers had them. In the early period of the war, they were pretty much exclusively for officers. But as the war went on, more and more ordinary soldiers had access to them. You had battles like Messines in June of 1917, where everyone from the general right down to the ordinary private was briefed on the situation. Now, private soldiers didn't carry maps like this in the battle, but section commanders and platoon sergeants would have them. So it was a piece of kind of First World War currency, battlefield currency, that was increasingly used by all ranks as the war moved into its final phases in 1917-18. But when you look at the map, it's got a kind of grid section on the front of the map, and we'll put some pictures of this onto the podcast website, and it shows the wider area around where the map actually is for, so you can get an idea of which sector it is. Now, it doesn't note principal towns and things like that on there, so unless you know the kind of grid pattern of these maps, you wouldn't immediately know what it covered. So you did know roughly where it was. The map has a title, and this one has a village name on the Somme battlefields at the top of it, Le Sars. Now, it covers a big wider area than Le Sars, and I'm just going to pull the map over just for a minute to see this, and you'll hear a bit of movement in the background. So this is the Le Sars trench map, 57D, southeast 2, and 57C, southwest 1, parts of edition 2B, scale 1 to 10,000. So the front cover tells us that straight away. And then what I'm going to do now is go through bits of this map to kind of explain how it works, and then we'll talk about some of the history connected to it. So if you know your Somme geography, you'll know that Le Sars, as the soldiers called it, is on the Albert-Bapaume road, that straight road that runs from Albert through to Bapaume, right through the middle of the Somme battlefields. And on this map, I've got spread out in front of me now, Le Sars is very much in the middle of the map. Up to the north are some of the villages on the rising ground that goes up towards the Ancre Valley. So we've got Warlancourt close by, the Butte de Warlancourt, which we've discussed in podcasts past, the village of Puisse, and then up towards the valley of the Ancre itself, there is Miremont. To the south of Le Sars, you've got the Eaucourt-l'Abbaye, which is a fortified farm complex that was very much at the heart of the German positions later on in the battle. And then off the map, you're going towards the village of Fleurs, and actually in the tiny little corner of the map on the right-hand side, there is a bit of the outskirts of the village of Fleurs itself. And then just to the left of where I've got my mic stand at the moment is Martinpuis. So one village I haven't mentioned that's on there, some of you may be already chomping at the bit knowing where it is, and that's Courcelette. And that's why I was interested in this map, because I've never owned an actual original trench map of Courcelette itself. I've had lots of copies, and I've used lots of copies for researching and writing about the battle there, but this was the first original map of Courcelette that I'd come across. And looking at it, it tells us all kinds of things about what is happening when this map is prepared and where this map then sat in the positions on the Somme at that time. Now, one of the first questions we want to ask when we look at a map like this is, what is its date? And we can look into the corner of the map to see that. It says, minor corrections to detail made 5th of May 1916. There's an ordnance survey mark next to it, also saying it's 1916. And then at the top of the map, and you see this on a lot of the sheets, it has a trenches corrected to statement in red. So this one says trenches corrected to 5th of May 1916. Now, on the 5th of May 1916, the Battle of the Somme had not begun. So this was an entire area behind the German lines. There was no fighting going on here. There might have been some very long-range artillery fire, raw flying corps activity over this ground, but there was no fighting. The fighting would arrive later on. So what you see with this is what the German positions this far back, and we're a few miles behind the German front lines here, what they consisted of at that time, and how they would connect to the story of what happened here later on in the Battle of the Somme in 1916. Now, German trenches at this stage of the war were marked on these trench maps in red and British lines in blue. And because this is behind the German lines, there's no blue lines on this one. Later on in the war, that was reversed. The colours were reversed. We don't need to worry about that with the 1916 map. But knowing that the trenches are in red, I can see a big, long red scar, as it were, going right across this map. And it is part of the main German line of defence, in this case running from near Puisse, across to Le Sarre, over towards the Eaucourt-l'Abbaye, and into the village of Fleurs. And bits of this would become part of, to the north, what would be Regina Trench, or Regina Trench, as the British and Canadians called it, and other bits would become part of the switch line that ran from near Martinpuy, right across Fleurs, around the back of High Wood, and over towards the grounds to the east of Longueval. Big lines of defence. And the Germans throughout the war looked at defence in depth, always in depth. So this is miles behind the German lines, and even in May 1916, before any kind of idea that the battle would be fought here, the Germans have constructed this fallback line just in case the Allies ever broke through. Now, because it is behind their lines, there's not a lot of other trenches on here. There's one or two coming in some of the villages, and then to the west, right over in the corner towards the next village beyond Courcelette, which was Pozières, there's part of the main German line of defence that was built in that area in the lead up to the Battle of the Somme. But when we look at the village of Courcelette itself, we see a kind of network of trenches around it. And again, I'll put pictures of this on so you can see this onto the podcast website. And when I look at this, I can see quite a few features that really come into play a few months later, 4 months later in this case, just over 4 months, when the Battle of Fleurs Courcelette took place here and the Canadian Corps made their attack on Courcelette village. They attacked from the left-hand corner of this map. The trenches that are marked on that corner were part of the Canadian front line, having taken over those positions from the Australians. And from there, they moved down into Courcelette village with men from the 22nd Battalion, the Vandoos, the French Canadians, fighting their way through the village, clearing the cellars, getting out to the far side of it. Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry coming in on their flank, coming around to the northern part of the village, various other units being involved there as well, and the village was captured on the first day of the operations, on the 15th of September 1916. And it was a significant battle for the Canadians in all kinds of ways. First time Canadian Corps had made an attack as a corps. Not every unit in the corps advanced simultaneously, but as a corps, this was their first time going over to the top into action. And it was also the first village that they had liberated in Canadian military history in the Great War and in the 20th century, and the first French village liberated by Canadians, something that would, of course, become commonplace as this war continued and would have kind of resonance on into the next war with the period of liberation in 1944 following D-Day, for example. So Courcelette became a very, very important byword for Canadian sacrifice, but also the Canadian contribution to not just the Battle of the Somme, but the First World War. But around the village itself, the Germans have already begun to construct some trench systems to protect the village, I suspect. They've built like a kind of a ring of trenches around the village. And to the south of the village, on the actual Albert Bapaume Road, there is a chimney marked, which is part of the sugar refinery that was there. And there's a whole network of trenches there. Then to the northeast, as a road and a valley runs up towards the other side of Lasar and between Lasar and Puys, there's a very, very distinct section of trenches there. Now, you might ask yourself, what is such a distinct section of trenches doing in a landscape so far away from the actual front line? But what these were practice trenches, and later on they became marked on British and Canadian maps as the North and South practice trenches. And it was an area that the Germans had built with a German set of positions and an enemy set of positions with a valley in between, and they would carry out trench warfare practice there, training for their troops, clearing trenches, attacking trenches, getting through wire, and then making their way through the ground and taking an enemy position. So the Germans built training areas just as the British Expeditionary Force built training areas behind their lines. The Germans did the same. And here at Courcelette, there was one constructed for the men of the 26th Reserve Division, which is the Württemberg Division that held the line from near Serre down to Thiepval and then south towards Auvilliers and La Boisselle, and was very heavily involved in all of the Somme fighting from the 1st of July onwards in those kind of areas. Courcelette was a headquarters then, so that's probably why they built some defences around it in case the enemy did it ever break through. Those headquarters could be defended. And it doesn't mention Chateau specifically on there, but I can see the Red Chateau just to the northeast of the village, which the Germans used as a headquarters and dressing station later on when the Canadians took this. They used it too. And it was the site of a battlefield cemetery, vast cellars that men could shelter in. Nothing remains of that chateau today. It was never rebuilt after the war. But it was one of several large buildings in the village that was used by the Germans, and then when the village was captured by the Canadians too. So when this map was prepared, this was way behind the lines. But looking at it, as I do, from the passage of more than a century and knowing the events that took place here, you know, I can see the fields that would become so important. And I can see by looking at the map why they became important, because the contour lines show the rising ground north of the village up to where Regina Trench would be eventually properly placed. And you can see why a defensive line would be built there, would dominate the landscape and prevent any attacker moving through that landscape, getting up to the north, up towards the Ancre Valley and the villages beyond. And you can see as well, well, I can see the kind of sunken lane on the eastern side of the village near to the civil cemetery. That was a position famous to the Canadian troops there, the limit of their advance on the 15th of September 1916. The cemetery was a German cemetery with a sizable number of burials in it, blasted flat by the battles there in 1916. What happened to the German soldiers who were buried there? There's kind of a mixed feeling about that. Some we know were exhumed after the war and taken to the Mandevilliers Cemetery south of the River Somme. Others may still be buried in there. And because it was a cemetery constructed some way behind the lines, the men are buried in coffins very deep, and I suspect their remains will never come to the surface. It would take some kind of archaeological dig to find those men, and I'm not sure that that will ever really happen, certainly not in my lifetime. But to the south towards the sugar factory, there was a long trench running alongside a track there, which was Sugar Trench, as the British would call it. And that is an area where tanks came into. Some of those first tanks used in the Battle of Fleurs-Courcelette supporting the Canadians. Probably some of the best use of tanks was alongside the Canadians in that battle. And they came into that area. But it also makes me think of my connection to that trench and that area close to the sugar refinery. And that was Lance Catamol, who was a young Canadian soldier who I interviewed in the last years of his life. He served there with the 21st Battalion Canadian Infantry. He was 16 years old during the Battle of the Somme, a teenage Tommy, underage, and his unit were given clear orders. They went into action there, no prisoners. And he described something that I've mentioned in previous podcasts about Courcelette, how they captured a trench there and they stood there on the parapet. Germans came out with their hands up. And he writes in his account of this, 5 bullets struck him at once, and they pulled the trigger of their rifles, and they shot down the German soldiers that were coming out to surrender, and he was one of those doing that. It's something that played on his mind for the rest of his life. One of the reasons why he was an unusual veteran for me, and he wouldn't let me record anything that he said, But he did say to me that, you know, when I'm gone, you'll read the true story. And he was as good as his word, because his account of that battle came to me in the post when he passed away, telling the terrible, grim story of what a young teenage Tommy had experienced there, being given orders, following orders, and carrying those orders out, shooting men down as they came out of their dugouts. War is a terrible, awful place, and I'm going to be the last person to excuse that kind of battlefield behaviour, but it's where minds go mad and where we see the worst of humanity in so many ways. And just by looking at this map, I can kind of picture those conversations with Lance, and then the shock of reading his account of that after he'd passed away. So these maps, really, when we kind of look at them, and I could go on kind of talking about different bits of this. To the south is Martinpuy, where more tanks came up in support of the 15th Scottish Division. Frederick Baker, one of the veterans I knew, came up through there during the Battle of the Somme. And there's so many stories. Every map square, these big numbered map squares, 1,000 yards across, so many men fought in this ground, so many men perished, were killed in this ground. You know, we're speaking about British and Canadian units, because the Germans threw unit after unit to defend this. German infantry units, German reserve units, their Marine Corps came in and fought. The German equivalent, if you like, of the Royal Naval Division served in this area and fought around Courcelette. There's so much rich history here, and the map shows us the landscape before those battles began. If we jumped on 5 or 6 months, we'd see a heavily populated map with lots of red lines of trenches, blue lines for the British forward positions that had captured gradually as they eked their way across this map and captured Courcelette and the ground beyond, and then Miremont to the south, and eventually Eaucourt, and eventually the Saar. It would be a very different kind of map. And when this map was made for the Germans, it was pleasant, open country. These were villages where they were out on rests. There were no civilians living there at that time. They'd all been evacuated. But this was a kind of home for many of these German soldiers. It would become that lunar landscape of the First World War very quickly once the fighting reached this area. And by the end of the war, very little of any feature that we see on this map had survived. So, yeah, this is just one map. One map covering a relatively small area of the Somme battlefields, an area already where, with Pozieres, with the Australians, Fleurs on the other side of the map where New Zealanders fought, British soldiers from all kinds of different regiments fought in all of the villages marked on this map, and the Canadians, of course, in those few small map squares in and around that village of Courcelette. Over 24,000 casualties, 8,500 of them killed in action, and of them 6,000 missing, that disappears into this landscape depicted on this map. And those names, nearly half those names on the Vimy Memorial, men killed on this part of the battlefield. Already we can see what these maps begin to tell us, and how important they are. So maps, I think, like the war damage postcards we discussed recently, are very much tactile objects that connect us to the history of the landscape on those battlefields of the Western Front. And the same would be true of maps of Gallipoli and Salonika and so many other places. And no doubt we will return to that subject. But when I look at the maps like this, my mind's eye sees immediately, as I start to look at the contours, it sees the rolling fields of the Somme. Or if it's a map of Ypres, the flatlands of Flanders and the beaks and the streams. And when I see specks of mud or pencil marks on some of these maps that I have, I think of the backstory that each map must have. What was this map's backstory? There's no name on this. Sometimes you have officers' names on these maps. There's nothing on here. Something like this would have been used probably by gunners in terms of firing anything into this part of the battlefield at that stage. But who knows, it could have been a map that had been issued to an infantry unit that first moved up close to this part of the battlefields so that they could annotate it with the latest positions. There's no evidence of that on this particular map, but that's the kind of thing that happened quite frequently. And when I look at maps like this, you know, I can visualise those battlefields. I think many of us, I think, can kind of do this. We close our eyes and we think of those places we know, and we connect it with all those different kind of layers of the First World War. And I find that even when I'm far away, I can sense the landscape through maps like this, through reading the texture of battlefields like the Somme that's portrayed on these maps. And when I'm there, these maps help me read the ground. Once upon a time, we used to take black and white copies of them provided by the Western Front Association. Now we can use digital mapping to do that. And all of it, it's another one of those layers. Layers which show the depth of this vast subject that the Great War is, and enable us to understand, jigsaw piece by jigsaw piece, that great history behind the old front line. You've been listening to Dispatches, part of the Old Front Line podcast, with me, military historian Paul Reed. If you've enjoyed this episode, please think about leaving a review on your favourite podcast platform, giving us a rating, and leaving a comment on the podcast website, oldfrontline.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter, and if you want to support the podcast, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/oldfrontline, or buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Thanks for listening, and see you again soon.